Now, some of you may have noticed that today on the front page of the Times, there is an article about platelets. And this has nothing of infamous memory. This has nothing to do with their job in blood clotting. Platelets are also a very good source of growth factors. We haven't explained how growth factors work, but we'll do that later in the semester. So what people have tried doing is taking a fraction of blood enriched in platelets and injecting it into the site of a wound. And these are places where there are very few blood vessels. So growth factors don't get there the usual way, easily. So, but you're essentially injecting a concentrated growth factor preparation into a wounded site that doesn't get much blood supply. And you don't have to worry about blood clotting because there isn't any. But you get the advantages of the growth factors from the platelets. And this technology is new, and the reason it made the front page is that it's big with sports, with professional athletes. But the hope is that it will really work. People are not sure, and that weekend athletes like yourselves who get a strained elbow or whatever will be able to use this. So I recommend taking a look. Now, today, I want to talk about four different organelles: the Golgi, the lysosomes, the mitochondria, and the peroxisomes. And we've been talking about how proteins get to their intended target. So we'll talk a little bit about the structure and function of these organelles, but the primary focus is going to be how do newly made proteins get to the right place. So let's start with the Golgi. We've already made it clear, and for this you want your handout 8A. We've talked a little bit about the Golgi, and we've made it clear that newly made enzymes, which are made on the rough ER, proteins made on the rough ER, go from the ER to the Golgi, where they get modified, concentrated, and sorted. So if you look at your picture, we have here two models of how things pass through the Golgi. But first, let's look at the basic setup and the structure. The Golgi is a stack of a stack. This whole thing is called one stack. And these are flattened sacks. They can be thought of as something like this, as we showed you last time. Or you can be thought of as each of these is like a pita with a hole in it, like a Mediterranean pita. So each individual sac also known as a cisterna has a lumen or a space in the middle and a membrane. Now we know that enzymes that are made on the rough ER end up in vesicles that bud off the ER. And there are enzymes or proteins inside the lumen, soluble proteins, and that these are going to be passed from one sac to the next sac to the next sac and out the other side. And the two sides of the Golgi, this is called the cis side, which is closer to the ER and usually closer to the nucleus. And the far side is called the trans. And there are usually multiple sacs in here, and the ones in the middle are called medium. And we know that these newly made proteins, which are usually referred to as cargo, are going to be delivered to the Golgi, and they are gradually going to pass from one sac to the next until they end up in a vesicle on the other side. Now, as we discussed last time, this vesicle can go fuse with the plasma membrane, either constitutively or in response to a signal. Or this vesicle can go to some other part of the endomembrane system. It can go to lysosomes, it can go back to the ER, etc. And we'll consider what directs it one way or the other in a little while. Now, what goes on inside the Golgi is the modification of proteins, addition and changes in sugar chains, and other modifications, although those are the major ones. Now, we know that the enzymes that do the modifications are located in the lumens of the sacs. Now, we've already explained that we know that the cargo moves cis to trans. As we'll explain, we're not quite sure how, but we know it does. We also know that there are characteristic enzymes associated with the trans part of the Golgi, characteristic enzymes associated with the medial, and characteristic enzymes associated with the cis. And these are the enzymes that do the modifications, that alter, add, and remove sugars. So I've drawn them like this. So there's cargo in here, and it's being progressively modified, but I haven't added anything to it to symbolize that. But there are different enzymes of modification in each sac. So this is a modification enzyme. And what's interesting is different ones are characteristic of each part of the Golgi. Now, when you have an enzyme that's always found in a particular organelle, and is a kind of marker for that organelle, it's also called a marker enzyme. Certain enzymes are characteristic, for example, of the medial part of the Golgi. So any sac that has that enzyme is classified as medial. There are classic enzymes that are markers, say, for the Golgi, for different parts of the Golgi, for the peroxisomes, different ones for lysosomes, etc. So the one other thing we have to add to our basic model, our basic setup here, is that there are vesicles. And those are shown here on the side. These are called transport vesicles. Now, we know that the vesicles, they bud off from the various sacs of the Golgi. And we know from experiments that if you have two different sacs and stacks in the same cell, the vesicles from one stack can fuse with the sacs of the other stack. But what we don't know is what the vesicles are carrying and which way they're going. So we definitely have transport vesicles. But the question is, which way do they go? Meaning, this way? Toward the trans or towards the cis? And what do they carry? Now, what are the possibilities here? And that's what our two models are about. So let's draw the other one. You may notice that the big difference is which way the vesicles are going. That in what is called a stationary model, what's stationary? The sacs are stationary. So once you set up the cis stack, the cis part with its characteristic marker enzymes, the medial with its characteristic enzymes, and the trans with its characteristic enzymes, that stays put. That's in your table, sort of the final step. Or you could notice at the top of the table it says, do the sacs move? Here the sacs do not move. The sacs stay put. So that's another question. Do the sacs move? Here the sacs stay put. That's why it's called a stationary model. In which case, what are the vesicles doing? The vesicles are carrying cargo. Once the cargo is modified as much as it can be in the cis, it's thought to go into a vesicle, And then that vesicle fuses with the medial. Then the enzymes in the medial get to work on the cargo. And when they're done, a vesicle fuses off and goes to the trans. And when the trans enzymes have finished doing their thing, then the vesicle fuses comes off and goes to the right destination. In which case, in this model, you notice that the vesicles are carrying cargo, as shown, in fact, in the table, and they're going in this direction, which is called forward or anterograde, meaning cis to trans. Now, this is sort of the way everybody just assumed it worked. But then it became clear that at least some of the vesicles are going the other way. So what's going there is the vesicles are going in the other direction. Now, if the vesicles are going in the other direction, what could be happening? What could be happening is the sacs are what move. The sacs are moving up or maturing or changing composition. So sac 1, then, this is not, this is why it's called a progression model, as versus stationary, because it refers to what the sacs do, the state of the sacs. That's this one. On the other hand, so again, cargo is moving. So the idea is that as one sac matures into the next kind, as the cis becomes a medial, the enzymes characteristic of the cis are recovered in the vesicle and added back to the new cis. And the medial gets them from the old trans, and the trans gets them from the vesicles before they butt off. So in this model, the vesicles are going retrograde or backwards, so to speak, relative to the cargo. And what they're carrying is not cargo, but modification enzymes. So you notice I've drawn them in properly, like this. Now you notice these models have two names, because you can look at it from the sac point of view, or you can look at it from the vesicle point of view. And so this one is also called a vesicle transport model. Now both of them are really vesicle transport models. But the left one is where the vesicle transport of cargo. Cargo is being transported by vesicles. So instead of looking at it from the sac point of view, we're looking at it from the cargo point of view, who's in charge. So here, the vesicles are carrying the cargo, carrying the cargo, and that's why in your second row here, it calls it the vesicle transport model. On the other hand, on the other model, in the progression model, the sac itself is carrying the cargo as it matures up to the next level. So that's also called a cisternal maturation model. Now, I think that the stationary model is sort of easy to understand, but the progressive one is a little harder. So I think it's easier if we do a little demo here with my model Golgi. So according to the progression model, here is your Golgi. Now it would have more sacs than this, but you get the idea. It has three kinds of sacs: cis, medial, trans. So what happens is that the trans sac finishes the job, and it falls apart into vesicles. A vesicle from here is, say, going to the lysosome, a vesicle from here to the plasma membrane, and so this one actually falls to pieces and disappears. But now, the vesicles coming from the ER come together and form a new sac. Now, in order for this to work, there were modifying enzymes in the old trans Golgi. So those modifying enzymes were captured by a vesicle, and they moved back and they fused with the new trans and delivered the enzymes. So as this sac moved up, the cargo stayed inside, but it got a new bunch of enzymes. The enzymes that used to be in this one, this used to be medial. So the medial enzymes were put into a vesicle and sent back to the medial. And the ones that used to be in here, this used to be cis. So the enzymes that used to be in here were moved into there. But the process continues. The enzymes from the trans are recovered. The sac breaks up into vesicles carrying cargo. They go to their destination. New vesicles from the ER carrying new cargo form a new sac. Now you notice that the green taped one has moved up the stack. In this system, the sacs mature. They change their enzyme content as cargo is modified, and they eventually disappear. Now, it is not clear that these are exclusionary, that it has to be all one or the other. It may be different in different organisms, in different tissues, and it may depend on what the cargo is. Some cargos are so large that we think they have to be transported by progressive sacs. And it may be that some vesicles move back and some vesicles move forward. This is still an active area of research, and no one is exactly sure of all the details, and they're still working on it. But these are the two basic ideas for models. And they're drawn on their handout and summarized in the table. So I want to leave the Golgi then with the idea that whatever new proteins were made, they have been passed from sac to sac, and all modifications done are necessary, and now they're in a vesicle. Now, in this picture, we only drew luminal proteins. But transmembrane proteins are passed along in the same way. A transmembrane protein coming from the ER will go into the first sac membrane, which will go into the second sac membrane, which will go into the third, which will go into a vesicle by either of these models. So before we leave the Golgi, what questions are there about all of this? Yes?
With the transmembrane protein, is only the inside part of the protein modified?
Very good question. If you have a transmembrane protein, let's draw it this way. It could be oriented with either the N or the C on either side. But now, which part of it can get modified? Only the part exposed to the enzymes inside is going to be modified. So only the luminal domain of the protein is going to get modifications. Now that means that if this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, only the domain that was luminal is going to have modifications. And that explains why, for proteins on the plasma membrane, it is always the extracellular side that has carbohydrates and not the cytoplasmic side. On the other hand, anything that's modified by cytoplasmic enzymes, it's going to be the reverse. If the cytoplasmic enzymes, say, add phosphate, then they can only get the part that sticks into the cytoplasm. Any other questions? Okay. So let's assume then that protein, which is destined for lysosomes, gets made on the ER, sent through the Golgi, and now it's ready to get to the Golgi, to the lysosome. How does the protein at the top here, the cargo protein, get from the end of the Golgi to the lysosome? And that's diagrammed on the other side of your handout. Now you remember that what lysosomes do is they contain acid hydrolases. They contain enzymes that break down macromolecules at an acid pH. So how do the enzymes get targeted to the right place? So if we look at the diagram here, if we start with the endoplasmic reticulum, the enzymes destined for lysosomes are made on the rough ER, and they're inserted into the lumen or the membrane of the ER. And then vesicles come off of that and go to the Golgi. That's our first part of our picture up there. Butt off the ER, fused with the Golgi. So I put two sample proteins in here. And in order to make this interesting, I've assumed that these two proteins have different destinations. I've assumed that the protein I wrote is a wiggle is going to go to the plasma membrane, and it's going to be automatically secreted. It's part of the constitutive secretion pathway, unregulated. But that the little circle protein is going to a lysosome. So they both get to the Golgi. And we actually know one of the major ways in which proteins are targeted to the lysosomes. And we know this because of a disease in which it messes up. So I'll tell you the normal first and then about the disease. So we know that in the Golgi, and I honestly don't know which part of it it is, I don't know whether it's the cis or the medial, that there is an enzyme that does the equivalent of adding mannose-6-phosphate to these proteins. Now, what happens really is there's a complicated carbohydrate which is rearranged, and when you get done, this is the last enzyme to make a modification, and when it gets finished, the end sugar is mannose-6-phosphate. So we've assembled that as a little triangle. So the protein that's going to get to the lysosomes has mannose-6-phosphate, and the protein that's going to go to the be secreted does not. Now, what's the difference? How would an enzyme know whether to add mannose-6-phosphate or not? There must be some localization, some sequence or patch in the protein which constitutes the substrate for the right enzyme. So we have an enzyme here, and if a protein has a certain sequence on it, the enzyme will bind to that protein and add mannose-6-phosphate, and if that sequence is missing, the enzyme won't do anything. So all the proteins that are destined for lysosomes have a certain sequence in them, and that causes mannose-6-phosphate to be added. Now, if you look at the trans-Golgi, or what is called the trans-Golgi network, meaning the trans side of the Golgi plus all its assorted vesicles, you look on the trans side, you would see that there are receptors for mannose-6-phosphate in certain parts of the Golgi. So let's say in this part, there are those receptors. So that means that any protein that has mannose-6-phosphate will stick to these receptors and accumulate in this part of the Golgi. So in step 4, we bind the M6P receptor, which is this. Okay. So now, remember we said the Golgi sorts and concentrates as well as modified. Different parts of the Golgi bud off vesicles with different content, just as different parts of an endosome do. So this part of the Golgi, so we're going to make two vesicles budding off our Golgi. One, well, we forgot our protein that's going to go be secreted. So our secreted protein ends up in one part of the Golgi and ends up being enclosed in one vesicle. And our proteins bound to the M6P receptor end up in a different vesicle from a different part of the Golgi, because where the receptors go, that's where the enzymes with M6P go. Now, in order to do this, you have to have a coat protein, such as clathrin, form to allow the deformation. We've left that out of the picture, but you have to have that. Well, what happens next? We know what happens to our secreted protein, and although those numbers are higher, let's just get rid of it. The vesicle containing the secreted protein is going to bud off. It's going to fuse with the plasma membrane. and it's going to release its material to the outside of the plasma membrane. So that's the so-called default pathway. This is a default vesicle. This is a vesicle that encapsulates anything that has no other instructions. And it ends up getting sent to the plasma membrane and released to the outside. But now, back to our protein destined for lysosomes. We get a vesicle again. It has the receptor, and it has the enzyme to go to lysosomes. Now, lysosomes, we don't want this receptor to go to the lysosomes. We want to recycle this receptor, just like you recycle receptors in receptor-mediated endocytosis. Now, to separate these two, where is the usual place for sorting out receptors and ligands? Endosomes. So this goes to an endosome. So it buds off in 6, and then in 7 it goes to an endosome. And the endosome, again, sorts. One end of the endosome gets the receptors, and one end of the endosome gets the enzyme destined for lysosomes. Now, again, and I've labeled it 8A and 8B, and it turns out to be matching to those same numbers on your receptor-mediated endocytosis handout. We get two vesicles. One contains mannose-6-phosphate receptors, and one contains enzymes destined for lysosomes. And so the vesicle with the empty mannose-6-phosphate receptors goes back to where it came from. So it's going to go back to the trans part of the Golgi. And it is thought that it is this protein here. There's something about the cytoplasmic tail that binds to the appropriate proteins that sends it to the right place. And that the vesicle containing the lysosomal enzymes, there's something in this membrane somewhere that sends it to a lysosome. So it either starts a new lysosome or joins a pre-existing one. Now, one of the things that we did not mention here, which I just want to say as an aside, is that many, many times here, we require two membranes to fuse. We haven't discussed the mechanism of that at all. That's discussed at length in cell biology. If you're interested in it, the way it works is called the snare hypothesis. And you can look in your textbooks or online to see the details. The simple idea is that if two vesicles are fusing, then each has a cytoplasmic protein which matches the other. And that traps them and leads to fusion. But we're not going to go into that one at all. So this is basically the normal cycle. The idea is that you have these mannose-6-phosphate receptors. They trap enzymes going to the Golgi, to the lysosomes, carry them to endosomes from where they are sent to the lysosome. And then the receptors cycle back again to the Golgi to do it again. Now, I said that we know about this because of a disease called eye cell disease. That's what ICD is. Now, it's named that. I stands for inclusion. In individuals with eye cell disease, not all tissues are affected, but in the ones that are, if you look inside the cell, you see inclusions, something in the cell that shouldn't be there. And these inclusions turn out to be sort of remains of lysosomes containing undigested material. Material that would normally be digested just lies around as garbage. Now, to explain how that happens and what you can do, how that happens, we have to go back and look at our picture again. So the second panel on the bottom, I've blown up the Golgi so that we can look at not just one or two proteins, but several at once. here's our Golgi. And it has two different vesicles forming from different spots. This part has the mannose-6-phosphate receptors. So it will trap anything that has mannose-6-phosphate that is supposed to go to lysosomes. And this part doesn't have any special receptors. It will form a default vesicle. Now, here I've put in a bunch of different proteins. Again, the wiggly protein is meant to go to the default pathway. And then we have a bunch of different enzymes, not just one, that's supposed to go to lysosomes. So what is supposed to happen, which is the equivalent to step three in our picture before, what is supposed to happen is we are supposed to add mannose-6-phosphate to what? Everything but the wiggles is supposed to get mannose-6-phosphate. So it doesn't get any, but all the little circles are supposed to get it, and the little diamonds are supposed to get it. Whoops. And the little flower-shaped things. That's what's supposed to happen. In eye cell disease, what is missing is the enzyme that adds or converts the pre-existing sugar to mannose-6-phosphate. So this step is blocked. Now, if this step is blocked, what happens? We're not going to put on the mannose-6-phosphate. In fact, the picture is going to look like the previous one. Now, if the cell, if this is what the inside of the Golgi looks like, our left picture, where will these enzymes go? Will they bind to the mannose-6-phosphate receptors? They can't. They have no mannose-6-phosphate. So, in fact, the whole shooting match is going to go into default vesicles, all of it. So all of these enzymes, they're all going to go to default vesicles. And they're all going to fuse with the plasma membrane, and they're all going to be released outside. So there are two problems with this condition. One is the enzymes that are supposed to be in lysosomes are outside, and they might digest something. They may not be so bad because it's not so acid outside, so they may not work very well. But the real problem is that what's going to end up in a lysosome? Well, probably these vesicles may butt off anyway. And then when you get to an endosome, the receptor is sent back where it comes from. You basically end up with an empty lysosome. You end up with lysosomes that have no hydrolases. So the things that are supposed to be degraded get sent to this lysosome, but there are no enzymes to degrade them. So the macromolecules that are supposed to be degraded just lie around in these enzymeless lysosomes and clog the cell. And they form the inclusion, and that's why it's called eye cell disease. Now, it is from this that we found out that you're supposed to add mannose-6-phosphate, and that's the signal, take me to a lysosome. So the protein has built into it an amino acid sequence that says add mannose-6-phosphate. And then once you get the mannose-6-phosphate, that binds to the receptors, and the protein goes to a lysosome. But in eye cell disease, it doesn't. Now, there are a bunch of other diseases that are better known that are called lysosomal storage diseases. Tay-Sachs disease is an example of this. So is Gaucher's, which is spelled like this. But since it's French, it's pronounced Gaucher. This is perhaps the most well-known one. Also, hurlers and hunters, which are mentioned in your problem set, are also storage diseases. Now, in these cases, it's not that you have no, essentially, lysosomal enzymes. What happens is one enzyme is missing. Or it's defective and doesn't work very well. So one class of macromolecule doesn't get degraded, but all the others do. But there's one class of thing you can't break down because of one missing enzyme. So let's look at our picture. What would that look like? When we got to here, what would it look like? One kind of enzyme wasn't made. So what would happen is, say, this one. This one's not made. And now when you get, do you have the enzyme? Yes. You have the enzyme for adding mannose-6-phosphate. So the circle and the rectangle enzymes all get treated fine. But there isn't any flower-shaped one. So in this case, all the enzymes that are supposed to go to lysosomes but one get to the lysosome. And the cells that, of course, are supposed to be in a default vesicle end up in a default vesicle. And depending on which enzyme is missing, you have Tay-Sachs disease, Gaucher's disease, etc. Now, it turns out you can do something about Gaucher's disease and some of the others. It doesn't work for all of these lysosomal storage diseases, but it works for Gaucher's. In order to explain, what it's called is enzyme replacement therapy. Now, usually if an enzyme is missing, you can't add it. If you add it to the person who needs it, it gets degraded before it gets where it's supposed to go. There are some exceptions. You can add insulin because insulin works in the blood. But most enzymes that work inside a cell, you can't deliver accurately to the right cell. But that's different for the enzyme missing in Gaucher's disease. Because the enzyme that's missing is supposed to be in a lysosome. Now, when you add a foreign protein by receptor-mediated endocytosis, where is it likely to end up? In a lysosome. So if you add enzymes, they generally end up in lysosomes, which is usually very bad news. But this enzyme is supposed to be in a lysosome. So this is a little like the old Brer Rabbit story of don't throw me in the briar patch. This enzyme belongs in the briar patch, no problem. So the reason this works is because of a variation on this scheme, which is actually drawn in the bottom half. You notice if you look down here with the endosome, what is supposed to happen? If you look in the bottom, the vesicle in the endosome, the enzymes with M6P and the receptors are supposed to separate. And the enzymes go to the lysosomes, and the receptors are supposed to go back to the Golgi. That's step 8A. A small proportion of the time, the vesicles that contain receptors end up fusing with the plasma membrane. This appears to happen in some tissues normally at a low rate. Well, what will be the consequence of that? If this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, where will that transmembrane protein end up? Which part will be facing the outside of the cell?
Receptors.
It's going to be the receptor. Now, at the same time that this occasionally happens, a few of the enzymes that have M6P in them sometimes get into a default vesicle. So once in a while, you have a vesicle that has some enzyme with M6P. So if it gets into a default vesicle, it gets outside. Can it be salvaged? It can, because notice ligand, receptor. Both of them are now outside the cell, and this is called the salvage pathway. By receptor-mediated endocytosis, the ligand binds to the receptor endocytosis as in your standard procedure. If this forms a vesicle by invaginating with clathrin, where will that vesicle go? We're going to get an endocytic coated, we're going to get a coated vesicle. It's going to get uncoated, just like on your RME handout, and it's going to go to an endosome. So, in fact, this time, if we sort properly, everything will go where it's supposed to go. So what this is presumably has evolved as a mechanism for capturing an occasional stray enzyme, lysosomal enzyme that's released, trapping it and bringing it back where it's supposed to go. Now, people can take advantage of this by adding the missing lysosomal enzyme. Because if a person has Gaucher's disease, can they add mannose-6-phosphate? Do they have normal receptors? They got everything. The only thing they haven't got is one enzyme. So what you have to do is add the missing enzyme. Does that enzyme have to have mannose-6-phosphate on it? It does. Because if I add this from the outside, nothing will happen unless it has mannose-6-phosphate on it. Because if it has mannose-6-phosphate on it, then the salvage receptors can grab it, take it in by receptor-mediated endocytosis, and I will be okay. Now, this has been used very successfully to treat Gaucher's disease and a few other lysosomal diseases. It depends on which tissue is affected whether this will work. Now, there is only one problem with this, and that's the expense. It costs something like $50,000 a year. Now, the reason it's so expensive is because you have to have mannose-6-phosphate on the protein. You can make human proteins in bacteria fairly cheap. But to get the right modifications, you have to make this enzyme in cells that contain a Golgi apparatus and can add sugars. So you have to actually use a line of vertebrate cells in tissue culture to make this. So the process of making this modified enzyme is quite tricky and expensive. And people are working on trying to figure out a way to make it cheaper. But for now, the stuff works wonderfully. The person takes the enzyme, and the enzyme, I think, is injected. It's captured by these salvage receptors, sent to the lysosomes, and replaces the missing enzyme. Now, could you use the technique in eye cell disease? Do they have receptors? Yeah, they have receptors. What if we added the missing enzymes with M6P on them? How many enzymes would you have to add? Whatever there is in the lysosome, which turns out to be 10, 20 enzymes. Well, 20 times 50,000 is not feasible. Okay, this is not going to work. Okay. Now, just to be sure you understand, who has more mutations? A person with Gaucher's disease or a person with eye cell disease? Who has more defective proteins? So I want you to think about this for a minute, discuss it, and come to a number. Who has more mutations and who defective genes, and who has more defective proteins? We're assuming that in both cases, the person is homozygous. Whatever mutations they have, both copies have it. Let me answer that. Okay, so let's take a vote. In Gaucher disease, how many genes are messed up? One? Come on, vote. One? Two? Three? More? One. We agree. What about eye cell disease? How many genes are mutant? One? More? How come more?
You have to have a separate enzyme to put the mannose-6-phosphate on each different...
Do you need a different enzyme to put mannose-6-phosphate on this protein and on this protein? Or is it the same enzyme? The answer is it's the same enzyme. So the same enzyme recognizes a sequence on this enzyme, on this protein, and it recognizes the same sequence on this protein, and it recognizes the same or a similar sequence on this protein. So there's only one enzyme adding mannose-6-phosphate to everybody. So if that one enzyme is defective, though, how many proteins are messed up? Many, not one. So this is an important principle, that if you mess up a single enzyme, whatever it was supposed to do gets messed up. And if it, what it was supposed to do was help with the manufacture of a lot of other things, they're all going to be messed up. So the mutation in eye cell disease has much more serious consequences, because that enzyme is part of the manufacturing and direction process. So each of these has only one mutation, but the effects are different. And if that isn't clear, ask me or TA. Okay, now, I think that's everything that I wanted to say about lysosomes and lysosomal diseases. Oh, somebody asked, what are the symptoms? The symptoms are different depending on which enzyme is missing. And that's in part because different substances have to be degraded in different cell types. So, like, Tay-Sachs disease is so devastating because it affects the degradation and turnover of a protein that is important to nerve cells. And as a result, when that enzyme is missing, the nerve cells of the brain essentially degenerate. While Gaucher's disease affects, I think, the cells of the digestive system. And so you do have, and I think to some extent maybe blood cells. So, but different cells are affected. And also each different disease has a different set of symptoms. And there is in fact a link in your notes to at least one website that lists all the various diseases and the various symptoms if you are interested. Are there other questions about this business? Yes.
Why couldn't they add something that would bind to more receptors so it would be intaken at a high?
Her question is there some other way you could get this protein? Isn't there some other receptor that would bind this protein? The problem is you want the protein to bind to the receptor that will direct it to lysosomes. So it has to be this receptor or it won't end up... There are perhaps other receptors that could direct it to lysosomes, but there's nothing about this that matches any other known receptor that I know of. Anything that would make it do that would be just as expensive to do. Yeah?
So by artificially adding these enzymes, the people show signs of normal behavior or whatever.
Most by adding these enzymes, most of the problems associated with the disease are greatly reduced. Not 100%, but greatly reduced. The people with Gaucher's, I know, have enlarged spleens. I'm not sure what else happens to them. And those symptoms disappear.
And why does it run out? Or what eventually happens that makes it run out so that you have to do it every year?
And why do you have to replace it over and over again? And all proteins in your body turn over. They don't just lie around and work forever. They work for a while, and like any other machine or substance, they wear out. So they are degraded, and they have to be replaced. Now, the idea of ends of gene replacement therapy is that you provide a copy of the gene, then you would only have to do it once. Because once you have the gene, you can make the protein, and the protein will do its thing, and when that protein wears out, you can make new protein. But as of the moment, that has not been successfully used in this disease or many others at all. Other questions? So in that case, I want to move on to our two other organelles, which are not part of the endomembrane system, to mitochondria and to peroxisomes. Now, if you remember back to last time, we had a handout where we discussed where are proteins made. And we said that the proteins that are going to go to mitochondria and to peroxisomes are generally made in the cytoplasm. And what I want to consider now is how those proteins made in the cytoplasm get into mitochondria and peroxisomes. And next time, we'll discuss how they get into nuclei. Now, I don't need to tell you much about the structure and function of mitochondria, because we talked about that last semester. But the important thing to realize, if we draw mitochondria, is that they do have DNA. But they use that DNA to make messenger RNA and to make protein. But they make relatively few proteins themselves. Almost all the proteins in mitochondria and in chloroplasts are made in the cytoplasm and imported into the organelle. Now, one way to keep straight what we're going to say is to compare mitochondria to lysosomes. And so there's a table a little further on in your notes, and we're going to put that up here and fill it up as we go. So if we want to compare lysosomes and mitochondria, one of the things we just said is if that's a picture of a mitochondrion, what does a lysosome look like? A lysosome only has one membrane. It is smaller, but we're not going to worry about that right now. So the membrane is one major difference. It's single versus double. Now, I want to remind you what that means. What are we talking about bilayer-wise? When we say this is single, is this a monolayer? No, it is not. This is a bilayer. But in a mitochondrion, you have two bilayers. You have the inner membrane and the outer membrane. So you have two bilayers. So that means if you want to get something into the matrix, it has to cross both bilayers to get to its proper destination. Now, we've already said, we've mentioned the DNA part. Mitochondria do contain DNA, which means, and they have the information to make their own message, tRNAs, etc. So they can translate and make a few proteins. Now, lysosomes have no DNA. So absolutely everything in a lysosome is made outside. We know it's made now on the rough ER and then transported to a lysosome. So how does a protein get into the matrix? We know that there are actually transport proteins in each of these membranes. And they are sort of like translocons or pores. So I can draw one here and one here. And cell biologists are crazy for acronyms. So this is called the TOM, and this is called the TIM, meaning the transporter of the outer membrane and the transporter of the inner membrane. Now, the thing that's interesting is that if you look at mitochondria closely, you see there are places where the inner membrane and the outer membrane are right next to each other. And at that point, the two transporters, the treat or translocators, are right next to each other. So you have a sort of double pore. And that's the point at which proteins made on free ribosomes enter the mitochondrion. So you have a free ribosome that is not attached to a message, but not to a membrane. And it's making a protein. And then that protein is finished. And now that protein can enter through, at this point here, which is this protein has to be unfolded in order to do this. And the protein generally has a specific sequence on its amino end, which is a kind of signal sequence, and it's usually called a transit peptide. And this area here, or this one, is usually called a contact point, because the two membranes and the two translocation pores contact each other. So the protein can wiggle through amino end first. And we know that because people have trapped the protein half in and half out. Now, how do you get the energy to drive the protein across the membrane? When proteins enter the ER, you have energy which is being spent to put the amino acids together and move the ribosome relative to the message. And some of that is sufficient to drive the growing chain into the organelle. But here, this is not the same. This is what is called post-translational import. In fact, we should put that in our table here. It's actually number 5 in the table. That, how do you get things in? It is co-translational at the same time as translation for entering the ER. This is into the ER, into the endomembrane system, and then it's passed on stage by stage through the ER and the Golgi to the lysosome. But it gets into the membrane or into the lumen co-translationally. But the mitochondria, you put things in post-translationally. That is, you make the protein first, and then you have to import it in. So where do you get the energy then to push this protein across the membrane? It turns out that you can use either ATP directly, or you can use a proton gradient. Because remember, mitochondria normally have a proton gradient because they pump protons, courtesy electron transport, across the inner membrane. And then the protons falling back down their gradient drive the production of ATP, the reverse of primary active transport. So that either form of energy, ATP or a proton gradient, is sufficient to allow you to take in the new protein as it's made. Now, there's an additional catch here, which is when a protein is made first. I drew it as folding up right away. But in fact, if it folds up, it has to be unfolded in order to wiggle through. So there is a protein chaperone or chaperonin, which either helps it unfold or keeps it unfolded until it has wiggled through. And then there's a second, so there's a chaperone in the cytoplasm to allow the protein to get or stay unfolded until it gets to the right place. And then there's another chaperone on the other side. There's a chaperone inside the mitochondria, and that helps pull the protein and fold it up properly on the inside. And it turns out that you need ATP to get the two of them apart. Once the two of them are happily together inside, one of the things you definitely need ATP for is also to separate the protein and the mitochondria. So let's see if we left anything out here. We implied this, but we didn't say it. Where did we actually make the protein that got into the lysosome? We made that on the rough ER. But in the mitochondrion, where do we make the protein? In the cytoplasm. Now, we made some proteins inside the organelle, but they didn't have to cross in. They were already there. And while we're at it, there is one more thing that goes in this number three here. How do you get more mitochondria? Turns out that mitochondria grow and split. That's not so surprising. Since they have DNA, they have to replicate their DNA, and new mitochondria have to each get a copy of it. And remember that mitochondria and chloroplast are thought to be the descendants of once free-living organisms. So they are sort of stripped down living bacteria, and they can't reproduce by themselves anymore because they're too dependent on all those proteins that come from the cytoplasm. But they do make more by growth and division. So they grow and they split. On the other hand, lysosomes appear not to do that. When you need more lysosomes, you make new ones. You make new vesicles, fill them with new hydrolases, and make new ones. So we think that, so the answer is grow and split? No. Yes. Now, we did say something else. When a protein is made, everything starts on free ribosomes. But if it's going to go to a lysosome, then that ribosome has to go to the rough ER, and the protein has to be inserted co-translationally into the ER. And then, when it gets to the end of the Golgi, that protein has to bind an M6P receptor and go to a lysosome. So what does that take? It takes energy, but it also takes signals. There has to be a take me to the rough ER signal, otherwise known as a signal peptide. There has to be a take me to the lysosome signal, which means add M6P. So we have to have actually a localization signal, number one, and localization signal, or I'll just call it LS, number two. For lysosomes, number one is the signal peptide, that's take me to the ER, and number two is the signal from mannose-6-phosphate addition, which means take me, once I get to the end of the Golgi, take me to add M6P in the Golgi, and take me to a lysosome. Now, what says take me to the mitochondrial matrix? That's this thing we call the transit peptide. That's some sequence of amino acids at the beginning. If this is missing, what will the protein do? It will stay in the cytoplasm. But if this protein, this sequence is present, then the protein will be ferried over and sent through to the matrix. So the localization signal is a transit peptide. There is probably no... Now, if all you want to do is go to the matrix, that apparently takes one localization signal. But where else in the mitochondria will you find protein? There's proteins in this outer membrane, proteins in the intermembrane space, and proteins in the inner membrane. So it takes additional signals to make a protein go to one of those places. Now, how do you get to one of those places? There are apparently two ways to do it. One is, on your way in, you stop. You say, go partially through the outer membrane, then you have one of those stop transfer sequences and you quit. You go through the outer membrane translocator, but not the inner. Or you could go all the way across the outer and stay in the intermembrane space. Or you could go through the outer membrane, through the space, through the inner membrane, and lodge in the inner membrane. And proteins are known to do all of those things, to go partway and then get stuck, because of whatever signals they have. However, some proteins are thought to go all the way into the matrix and then perhaps to insert into the inner membrane or to cross it to the space between using the same mechanisms that proteins in the rough ER use to do the equivalent thing. Now, there is only one thing we forgot to say here. Once a peptide with a transit peptide gets into the matrix, what happens to the transit peptide? It turns out that inside the matrix is an enzyme-like signal peptidase. There's an enzyme that cuts here and removes the transit peptide. So usually, you cut off the transit peptide once the protein is inside. That is thought to prevent the protein from wiggling out again, and it may also reveal additional signals to send the protein further. Now, we have another organelle on our list. We have not only mitochondria, but peroxisomes. What are peroxisomes, and how do things get to them? We know what mitochondria are. They're responsible for oxidative energy metabolism. But what are peroxisomes, and how do things get to them, and what do they do? Peroxisomes have certain features in common with mitochondria and other features in common with lysosomes. And in your notes, there are two tables, one each way. But I'm going to do it a little differently. I'm just going to add what is in the first table to this one. In your notes, there's one table that compares these two and one for these two. But we're just going to combine it for the moment, and then you can go back and look more carefully. Peroxisomes, what do they look like? They look like lysosomes. They're about the same size, and they have a single membrane. So in that respect, peroxisomes are like lysosomes. Now, what about the DNA business? Again, peroxisomes don't have any. But what about growing and splitting? It turns out that we think most of the time that's in fact how they reproduce. That people, they definitely do grow and split. Now, they may occasionally be made de novo, but most of the time in a normal cell, we think that they get bigger and divide in half, even though they have no DNA. So in that respect, they're like mitochondria and not like lysosomes. Now, where are the proteins of peroxisomes made? Peroxisomes are not considered part of the endomembrane system, and most, virtually all of their proteins are known to be definitely from the cytoplasmic ribosomes. Now, peroxisomes have two sets of proteins, the ones in the lumen and the ones in the membrane. And we know that all the proteins in the lumen come from the cytoplasm, cytoplasmic ribosomes, no question. It's not entirely clear where the proteins in the membrane come from. Some of them may actually be made on the ER, inserted into a special part of the ER membrane, which then makes vesicles that fuse. So exactly how these proteins get where they're going is not entirely clear. What is clear from analyzing drugs and mutants is that there's two different ways, and the proteins that go to the lumen are handled differently than the proteins that go to the membrane. Even the proteins in the lumen are not all handled the same way. They don't all have the same localization signal, and there's a problem in your problem book about two different enzymes that have different ones. Most of the enzymes that end up in the lumen of peroxisomes have the same type of localization signal and are handled by the same transporters. But a few of them appear to work differently. So, certainly everything in their lumen comes from cytoplasmic ribosomes. Now, how does the protein get imported? All the lumen or matrix proteins are imported post-translationally. Now, all the proteins from the cytoplasmic ribosomes come in post-translationally. But there's a difference in the way proteins get into peroxisomes and the way proteins get into mitochondria, which is significant. All the mitochondrial proteins seem to be unfolded and wiggle across. Some, at least, of the peroxisomal proteins appear to be able to get into a peroxisome without unfolding. They can fold up in the cytoplasm, stay folded, and get sent into the lumen or matrix. And no one really knows how this works. So in this respect, we have something that's different. It's not the way it is with lysosomes, not the way it is with mitochondria. It's different. So it's post-translational, but it's folded. Now, we've already said something about the localization signal. Not all localization signals are the same, but most localization signals to get into the lumen or the matrix of a peroxisome are generally on the carboxyl end. Now, notice this is different. In the case of a protein that says, take me to the mitochondrion, the signal is generally on the amino end. Which makes sense, because as soon as you start to make it, you have to bind the chaperones and keep it from folding. But the signal that says, take me to a peroxisome, is on the carboxyl end. But that's okay, because the protein can fold up. And you don't see the signal till it's too late. You've already folded, but it doesn't matter, because a folded protein can get into a peroxisome. Now, what are peroxisomes for? Let's very briefly discuss that. Peroxisomes are quite variable from one organism to another. But animal peroxisomes, which is the kind we're most interested in, are primarily involved in detoxification. They're also involved somewhat in the degradation of fatty acids. Now, peroxisomes look like lysosomes. They're the same size and the same density. But the reason we know we really have two separate states, two sets of vesicles, is first of all, if you stain in situ, if you add substrate and look where the product is, you see that the enzymes inside lysosomes and the enzymes inside peroxisomes are different. That substrate is made into product in one and not in the other, depending on which substrate you use. So they're clearly different organelles with different enzymes and different characteristic marker enzymes. That alkaline acid phosphatase is characteristic of lysosomes. And for peroxisomes, catalase and peroxidase are two enzymes that are localized to peroxisomes. Another way we know they're different is that people thought of the trick of feeding rats detergent in their food. That sounds terrible, but angel food cake mix has detergent in it. So do a lot of other things. The reason for feeding detergent is it's an amphipathic molecule, and it associates with lipid, and it goes to lysosomes. So what happens is the lysosomes of the rats who ate detergent are lighter because they have more phony lipid, and so by centrifugation, they can be separated from the peroxisomes. So by that trick, people have physically separated lysosomes and peroxisomes by traditional biochemical grind and find methods. So when you are all done, what is the point of peroxisomes? Why carry on these reactions in a vesicle instead of the cytoplasm? Both lysosomes and peroxisomes contain something which is dangerous. In the case of lysosomes, it's acid hydrolases, enzymes capable of degrading macromolecules if you let them loose. In the case of peroxisomes, it is true that these enzymes are capable of oxidizing some things. But what's really worrisome is that peroxidase generates hydrogen peroxide as a product. And this compound is a very strong oxidizing agent. And if this compound is allowed to float around, it will oxidize all kinds of things you don't want oxidized, and it will mess the cell up. So what's been done is, what has evolved is a system where the peroxide is generated inside a vesicle, and in that vesicle is the enzyme catalase. And catalase, in fact, destroys peroxide. It converts it to harmless substances. And the actual reactions are written in your notes for reference. And the basic idea is that inside a peroxisome, you can oxidize things and get peroxide, and then you destroy the peroxide. Now, why would oxidation detoxify? Some compounds, when oxidized, are just less toxic than they used to be. So that's good news. But a major issue with detoxification is that if you have something which can be oxidized, and this is the reaction catalyzed by peroxidase. This is the peroxide. Often, the oxidized form is more soluble. Now, soluble compounds are much more easily eliminated by the body. Because once they get out of a cell, they can travel through the blood and they can be excreted in the urine. Lipid-soluble material can't travel through the blood. It has to have a carrier to do so. And if there's no carrier, it just sticks in membranes. And when it sticks in membranes, it just accumulates in the body. People have discovered by bad luck that eating polar bear liver is toxic. It has so much vitamin A and so much vitamin D in it, which are lipid-soluble vitamins, that they just accumulate in body tissues. And not only do you turn orange, but in fact, it kills you off. Now, the water-soluble material then is transported out of the cells using transporters, but once it gets into the blood, you can get rid of it. So that's a major function here. And then catalase destroys the peroxide, producing often more oxygen. So do it again. Now, we have explained how if you make proteins in the cytoplasm, how you get them into peroxisomes, and how you get them into mitochondria. And what we will explain next time is how you get them into nuclei, and then we'll talk about the structure of nuclei. Now, I want to remind you about the open houses again. Also, if you didn't get handouts from last time and you need some, they're here. And we hope to have the exams back Thursday, but I can't promise anything.